From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, David Byrne wants his songs to make people think, and because of that, he feels his music might be a little out of step with modern songwriting.
I hope that doesn't mean that they're not emotional, but they don't seem to be what most of the world of songwriters is doing. And I thought, I might be on my own little island here.
And studio executives are talking the talk, but not exactly walking the walk when it comes to hiring female directors. Maybe it's because most of those executives are men. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
And by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards, including lead actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, and Best Picture of the Year, awards eligible in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. David Byrne broke a 6-year hiatus last year when he released his album American Utopia. But since 2012, when he made Love This Giant, a collaboration with St. Vincent, the former Talking Heads frontman has been busy. Byrne released his 9th book, How Music Works. He debuted a stage production of his concept album, Here Lies Love, and he launched a multimedia platform aimed at raising social consciousness called Reasons to Be Cheerful. He named the platform after a 1979 song by the British new wave artist Ian Dury.
Somebody holly, the working folly, good golly, Miss Molly, and boats. Hammersmith Pally, the Bolshoi Bally, jump back in the alley, and nanny goats.
Byrne wrote his Grammy-nominated album American Utopia prior to our nation's recent political discord, but he remains determined to find the silver lining in all the chaos. When I spoke with Byrne, he connected the dots between his latest projects and Dury's song, Reasons to Be Cheerful, Part 3.
I remember that song. That song came out during the Thatcher era in Britain, which was an era where many people, especially musicians, were not feeling that cheery. And he came out with this song called Reasons to Be Cheerful. I think it was part one or part two, whatever, as if there were it was to be continued. And most of the reasons to be cheerful were slang or Cockney in Cockney rhyming slang. So you had to look it up and go, what does he mean by that? And they were all very personal things, little things in life that he was reminding us are wonderful. And I took inspiration from this, that song, gosh, many, many, many years later. And I took a slightly different direction with a similar idea where I started collecting examples of things that made me cheerful about the world in general, whether it was a local initiative in energy conservation or something in education or health. We tend to wake up and read the papers and read about bad things. And just like a lot of other people, I'd get really upset. It would kind of, my stomach would get in a knot and it would kind of ruin at least the first part of my day. And then I realized I need to find an antidote to this.
And it feels like to me that there is a direct connection between Reasons to Be Cheerful and what you're doing on that website, reasonstobecheerful.world, and the liner notes for your latest album, which say in part, we look around and we ask ourselves, well, does it have to be like this? Is there another way? These songs are about that looking and that asking. This album is indirectly about those aspirational impulses. Sometimes to describe is to reveal, to see other possibilities. To ask a question is to begin the process of looking for an answer. Do you find those two things to be really connected, Reasons to Be Cheerful and the themes that you're exploring in American Utopia?
I wasn't conscious of any connection when I was writing the songs, but looking back, I realized that I was kind of working in parallel. The songs certainly don't give answers. Some of the songs can be kind of dark, but they do ask, I think questions that we're all asking. Questions about, is there a better way? Is there a different way? Who are we? What's our place in the world? And will that help us find answers to the way things are at the moment.
I want to talk about politics and one of the songs off your latest album. The song is called Dog's Mind, and it makes reference to a president. Let's hear a little bit of the song.
The judge was all hungover when the president took the stand, so he didn't really notice when things got out of hand. Then the press boys thank the president, and he tells them what to say. There's a photo opportunity, and then they're sent away.
So I'm wondering, it's easy to conflate the point of view of a song with the point of view of the person who's singing it. How close are the two on this album, and maybe in particular on this song?
I think of that song as it starts off painting a kind of bleak picture of contemporary politics. To be clear, it was written before Donald Trump was elected, so it's not specifically
about him. That was my next question.
Yeah, it was written before that, and so it's not specifically about that, but it's about the kind of the general bleakness of our political situation. But what the song is really about, I think, is how limited and blinkered our point of view of the world is. Because it kind of switches and it starts talking about, well, what does the world look like from a dog's point of view? Is our perception and our point of view and our biased view of the world just as limited as we think a dog's view is? And the answer has to be yes.
What does it feel like to write a song that turns out to be that prescient? You said you wrote it before Donald Trump was elected, and yet the impact of the song, I would say, has changed materially since he was elected. What does it feel like to be the author of a song whose reception is going to be changed so fundamentally by events?
I felt like I was very lucky in some ways. It felt like, oh, well, I guess this has stayed relevant. It's a little bit tragic that you feel like, well, things haven't really changed, have they? In fact, this bleak picture that I painted has actually been very much realized. That tells me occasionally kind of just trust your instincts, the way you feel about how things are, because you might be seeing something before it becomes manifest.
The rose is pruned to a perfect shape.
Coming up, how David Byrne built his touring band to look like the rest of the country.
The chicken thinks in mysterious ways, but beauty is not what we're after. Now the chicken imagines a heaven full of roosters and plenty of corn.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. Nominated for 4 SAG Awards, including Outstanding Performance by a Cast, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Supporting Actor, for consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director. And Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, nominated for 5 Golden Globe Awards for Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Screenplay and Best Picture of the Year. Also nominated for 3 Screen Actors Guild Awards, 14 Critics' Choice Awards, including Best Picture, and one of AFI's 10 Best Pictures of the Year, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's get back now to my conversation with musician David Byrne.
Well, I wish I was a camera. I wish I was a postcard.
On his latest album, American Utopia, the socially conscious singer reminds us there's plenty to be cheerful about. The song you're hearing now is Everybody's Coming to My House. It's about inclusion and welcoming, and the message mirrors Byrne's own efforts to make his touring band as diverse as the rest of the country.
When I was putting the band together for this show, of course, I was thinking about musicians that I loved and whose playing would be appropriate, but I was also thinking about how I wanted to represent kind of a society in miniature with the band. I mean, I knew we were going to be a big band. We were going to be 12 people. And I thought, I want to show the diversity of people that are out there, the people that make up this country, with, as you said, the racial diversity and sexual diversity and gender and everything else. We can be what it is we're talking about. We don't have to just talk about it. People can see it right in front of their eyes when they come to one of these shows.
I want to play another song from the album. It's called Doing the Right Thing. So there's a fascinating break in this song where the string arrangement gets interrupted by this synthesizer moment, and it made me wonder about how much of your songwriting is influenced by choreography. You've worked with Twyla Tharp in the past on Catherine Wheel. On this, you worked with Annie B. Parsons. How does choreography change the way you think about bridges and shifts inside the music?
That particular shift was something that Brian Eno did, and I loved it, so I kind of encouraged it and tried to exaggerate it. It's true that when I was working on this record and the songs were beginning to take shape, I immediately thought, this is going to be fun to do live. This makes me want to move, and it makes me want to move in a specific kind of way. And I thought, oh, that's going to be fun. That's going to be fun. I'm going to keep that in mind.
The staging of the tour for this album has gotten a lot of praise. It's a bare stage. All the musicians are carrying their instruments. There are no visible amps or mics or shoes. It's how you performed at Coachella last year. How did that idea about staging come to be, and what were its greatest challenges?
This idea of the staging kind of evolved from things I'd been doing before. A few years earlier, I'd done an album and a tour with St. Vincent, and I had the idea to have all the brass players. We had a lot of brass on the record. But I thought, let's have all the brass players be mobile, because they can. And you can put clip-on mics onto the bells of the trumpets and horns, and they can move around. So we could make patterns and change the shape of the stage that way. It was also something my booking agent said to me at one point, and I don't think he meant exactly this, but he said there was something very exciting that I had done on a previous tour where I brought out a kind of an alternative marching band to join us on stage. And just the numbers of people on stage, he said, was just thrilling for an audience. And I thought to myself, people like to look at people more than they like to look at screens.
That's true.
And so I thought, I'm going to make the show about people, not about kind of spectacle and effects, although we did work a lot on the lighting. But I thought, it's really going to be about the players and the people and what they're doing. To me, if I can make that come across, I think that will really be powerful for an audience.
We're talking with David Byrne about his album, American Utopia. Without it sounding like we're back in my college rhetoric class, I want to ask you a little bit more about how you approach lyrics on this album and the idea of optimism, of asking questions. Because in the past, when you've dealt with some of these issues, you've been highly ironic. I want to play a song from your 1998 album, Naked, called Nothing But Flowers. It's interesting, too, if you go back and look at the music video for this, there are statistics about acres of rainforest being cleared and the number of privately owned machine guns. But I'm wondering, as a songwriter, when you think about whether or not you're going to be ironic, what kind of tools of rhetoric you're going to use, do you think consciously about how you're going to structure a song? Are you going to ask questions? Are you going to try to give answers?
I do what a lot of people do, and I jot down little ideas. And then I'll come back to those, say, a year later and look at them and go, oh, okay. And then with a fresh look, you can kind of see where there's something that needs to be organized a little bit more and that something's trying to say something, but you can kind of say it in maybe more interesting way or in a way that's a little less expected. I do realize, as I was kind of finishing up my record, and this could apply to a lot of my records, I guess, that as we do, I started listening to kind of regular radio and the various playlists online and this and that, and I thought, wow, you're kind of miles away from what a lot of songs are about. A lot of songs are about a person's lives and their loves and their anger and frustrations and those kinds of things. But without criticizing any of those things, a lot of my songs seem to be about kind of ideas. And I hope that that doesn't mean that they're not emotional, but they don't seem to be what most of the world of songwriters is doing. And I thought, wow, I might be on my own little island here.
It's a good little island, though. you have a Grammy nomination for Best Alternative Album. It's your first ever. And a friend of yours, Annie Clark, who records at St. Vincent, is also nominated in that category. You made an album together a couple of years ago. Who else are you eager to collaborate with?
Oh, wow. I'm not sure. Sometimes I just fall into those things. We'll see what happens. I don't have any immediate plans. I think Annie and I are going to go as dates to the Grammys, which I thought, well, that's a nice thing. We're both nominated in the same category.
So let the better dressed person win.
Oh, geez. I'm not going there.
Criterion recently released your 1986 film, True Stories, and to me, it feels like there's a real connection to the album. Would you say they have something in common, and how would you describe it?
Yeah, there is. There, funny enough, yes. When I was doing that film and the album, it was kind of a love story, you know, a love appreciation about the kind of various eccentric people in Texas and by inference in the United States of America. And although a lot of people perceived it at the time as being sort of ironic, and I thought, how can this kind of new wave New York guy be actually kind of appreciating people in the middle of the country? People in Texas really enjoyed it. They saw themselves in there.
Before we begin, I want to just tell you a little story that I heard about Texas recently in a local tavern. It seems though God was working around the earth here, trying to make it beautiful, just like the rest of the world. He had to knock off because it was nighttime, and he said, I'll come back tomorrow and make it just as pretty as the rest of the world, with lakes and streams and mountains and trees. And he got back the next day, and he saw that the ground had completely hardened. Like concrete. And he didn't want to begin all over again. No. In his infinite wisdom, he had an idea. He said, I know what I'll do. I'll make some people that like it this way.
They can laugh at their own strangeness and eccentricities, but they also can see their originality and their sense of be whatever you want to be, and you can make yourself into whatever you want to be. You can invent yourself. So in certain ways, it's very hopeful. It's very much a love letter to a lot of those people. And I think that part of what I do hasn't really changed that much.
David Byrne, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Someone in a dangerous place.
And just to clarify, this is Byrne's first Grammy nomination as a solo artist. His former band, Talking Heads, did receive a couple of nods. Coming up, a new report titled Inclusion in the Director's Chair finds some progress and a lot of room for improvement in the movie industry.
They can't get in. Many people, they pay no mind. Many people, they leave this place.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Each year, researchers at the USC Annenberg Inclusion Initiative look at the directors of the top 100 grossing films of the previous year and assess how diverse and inclusive the movies were in terms of gender, race, and age. Today, they're out with their figures for 2018, and for the first time in a long time, there's a little good news. Thanks to films like Black Panther, Black Klansman, and A Wrinkle in Time, and their respective directors, Ryan Coogler, Spike Lee, and Ava DuVernay, last year was a banner year for Black filmmakers. USC professor Stacey Smith and her co-authors also, for the first time, examined the race and gender of studio executives, producers, and below-the-line positions like cinematographer and composer. The findings there, especially for women of color, were really dismal. But when I spoke with Stacey Smith, we started with the good news.
2018 was a breakout year for Black directors. 16 different directors helmed one of the top 100 films last year. This is twice as many as we saw in 2007 and almost three times as many as we saw in 2017. So I think there is cause for some celebration here. Hollywood has finally got the memo that inclusion matters, and their hiring processes reveal steps towards more inclusivity on set.
Okay, I'm going to rain on your parade a little bit, because if you step back, the numbers and the trends are still pretty striking. You looked at the 1,200 top grossing films from 2007 to 2018, and of the filmmakers behind those movies, only 4.3% were women. And in terms of progress, 2018 was worse for female directors than the year before, as their share of jobs plummeted from 7.3% to 3.6%. And for those of you who understand math, that's a drop of more than 50%.
Right. And I think that when we look at female directors and we look at the trends across the 12 years, I think what we're seeing here is a problem for women in general. But when we look to women of color, there were only 9 out of 1,335 hires. And so we really have to think about intersectionality when we talk about female directors, because we're really seeing a floor effect, particularly with women of color.
And it's also not just men who get the jobs, it's white men almost all the time. Fewer than 10% of the male directors from those 1,200 films were either Black or Asian.
Absolutely. Now, one interesting finding that we do have in the report is that we took a deep dive on the last 300 films over the last 3 years. And what we do see just over that shorter amount of time, we see a notable uptick from 13% of all directors in 2016 are from underrepresented racial ethnic groups. And in 2018, that number jumps to 22%. So we're seeing progress. It's not as fast or as steep, perhaps, as some of us would like to see. But I think it becomes really important to acknowledge the positive steps that Hollywood has taken and the giant leaps that still need to happen for particularly women and other underrepresented groups behind the camera.
You did a couple things in this study that I was really interested in. One is what I'll call the Sundance effect, and that is men who have successful independent films seem to have a much easier time moving from Sundance to big budget productions than women. What do the numbers say about that?
Well, what we're seeing really interestingly in the research is that there's a one-and-done phenomenon for most women. They get one chance across this 12-year span of time, whereas their male counterparts get more at-bats, if you will. And this is really problematic because it affects the career sustainability for female directors. And what if you really look at the data closely, what you see is that the studios are adding a few new women each year, as opposed to going back to the roster of talent and including them in hiring decisions as well. So one of the ways in which we can accelerate change is to do both.
You looked at some below-the-line jobs that are heavily tilted toward men. 97% of cinematographers from the top-grossing films for the last 2 years were men. Almost 98% of the composers were men. Nearly 85% of the editors were men. And if you're a woman of color, good luck.
That's absolutely right, John. And what we're really seeing is that the production process, whether it's on set or in post, or even in pre, we're seeing a real whitewashing. I think one of the most important things with this investigation is to really line up some of the findings back to back to show just how steep the impediments are for women of color. Zero DPs across 300 movies over the last 3 years. 1.4% of editors are women of color. 1.5% of production designers, 1.6% of producers, and only one out of 301 composers are women of color. You add that in to some of the other statistics that we have, less than 4% of critics that are women of color, very few female leads are women of color, and you're seeing erasure across an entire sector of an industry. It's time for that to change. And I'm really hoping that these numbers are a wake-up call that men and women from all backgrounds need to have access and opportunities to be storytellers.
Stacy, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It was great to be here, John. Thank you.
And one final note about the study. Only 9 directing assignments were filled by women of color among the 1,200 top-grossing pictures over the last dozen years. Those 9 jobs were held by 7 women, 4 of whom were Black, 2 Asian, and 1 Latina. And that's all we have for the week. The Frame is produced by Oscar Garza, Darby Maloney, Monica Bushman, and Jonathan Shiflett, with help this week from Julia Paskin. And our engineer is Valentino Rivera. I'm John Horn. Have a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday.